With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Publisher Podcast. It's time for the Publisher Podcast.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England pound.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week, and in this episode I'm speaking to Mike Shaw. Mike is the director for EMEA ad sales at Roku. He's somebody I always enjoy speaking to, as well as being a lovely human being. He's extremely knowledgeable about various aspects of the industry and articulates everything exceptionally well, I think. I also think the CTV operating systems, they sit right at the heart of the industry and they get a really interesting view. They're at this intersection where they get a lot of visibility into what's actually going on right across the industry. So, yeah, it's an interesting episode. We talk about the CTV operating system market and why we have so many today. And we also talk about how easy or how difficult it is to get started with a CTV app today. We also discuss the benefits and the costs of being an open platform. Roku is more open than most CTV operating systems, which is great from an ecosystem point of view, but it doesn't come without complications either. And we also talk about TV commerce and shoppable video, my slightly barmy idea for competing with YouTube, and of course where Mike would invest $10 million today. Mike's somebody I could listen to all day, and I'm fairly sure that you'll feel the same after listening to this episode. Right, before we cross over to Mike, we've got a few things coming up from Video Week. We're starting to look at 2026. Actually, I can jump in with one for 2025. We've got one table left for Video Week 100, which might be gone by the time you listen to this. But Video Week 100 is our end of year networking event / party / get some business deals and new leads over the line for 2026. It's taking place at the NED in London. It's going to be a great day. It's always a very fun end of the year and a great crew. We're always very blessed with a really great group of people. So that you can look at the Video Week 100 website if you're interested in that. Then in March, we've got the Video Advertising Buyer's Guide launching. This is a brand new guide aimed at media buyers from brands and agencies. We want to create a kind of Bible for omnichannel video buying. There's so much complexity in the market, and you know, particularly for those who are confronted with a huge array of options, whether it's CTV, whether it's what online publishers or social are offering, if it's what digital out of home or even gaming. We want to create something that creates, condenses the full spectrum of options for media buyers, what they should be looking out for, where they're going to find the truly quality media that delivers for their brand. And so if your company would like to feature in that guide, please get in touch via the Video Week website. Partnerships at videoweek.com will also ensure that you're greeted with a enthusiastic message. From April 15th to 16th next year, we'll be running our flagship conference, New Video Frontiers. That'll be at King's Place. It's going to be a bigger and better event this year, something we aim for every year. But this year we're expanding to 2 days at King's Place. So if you're traveling from abroad, you might want to book those flights, or if you're interested in getting involved, now would be a great time to be speaking to us. Okay, so now I will cross over to my chat with Mike, and I hope you enjoy. Mike, we finally got here. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Vincent. Very good to speak to you.
It's a bit of a prestigious moment for the podcast. We've got the Hugh Grant of CTV here. It's not just your voice and the way you carry yourself that is Hugh Grant-esque. I believe you've actually got a Hugh Grant origin story from when you were younger.
I I do. Back in the very late 90s, when I was younger, had floppier hair and stammered a lot more. A good friend of mine from university was driving through Richmond, looked to his left at a traffic light to see who he thought was me in an open top car, looked over, said, "Hello, Mike," to which Hugh Grant turned round, looked back through his window. And to probably to this day, until Hugh is listening to this podcast, is wondering who is Mike Shaw. So, yeah, back in the day, pre-haircuts and a very long time ago, I did have a Hugh Grant similarity. My wife would say that Liz Hurley obviously has been her benchmark, but I couldn't possibly go into that.
Yeah, but I'd like to pretend that Brad Pitt is mine, but sadly, I haven't had any confusion. How did you come to be in the industry in the first place? You're leading Roku in Europe today, but yeah, how did you first get in?
I think, as with most people in media, kind of by mistake is the short answer to that. So I'd started actually when I was at university doing business and finance. I'd started in enterprise software. My placement year was at Hewlett-Packard out in Bracknell, working on the exciting world of evolving mainframe computing. But lots of the use case for that was actually around, and the customers for it were the organizations that were building out the kind of what's now the direct-to-consumer, the B2C internet proposition. So when I graduated, rather than go back to Hewlett-Packard, I got into a small research startup called Fletcher Research that were starting to do a lot of work around the future of retail and would internet retailing really kick in, and how was mobile telephony going to alter the way consumers communicated. They were bought very, very quickly by Forrester. And so I spent 5 years working in the media and telco team there before wanting to specialize in advertising, and specifically how that advertising decisions, planning and trading were being made. So I went to Comscore, who at the time were building out one of the standards, one of the currencies for web audience measurement, which was the tools of the day for how planners at agencies would be able to allocate campaign budgets online. I then, having done 11 years there, really wanted to get into more of the trading side. So I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity at DataZoo, then an independent demand side platform, DSP, which was working with agencies, but also with in-house brands around how they transacted their digital media. And it was DataZoo's acquisition by Roku in November 2019 that brought me into this organization. And as you say, I'm now leading the UK and European advertising business, very focused around how TV and connected TV ads are evolving.
DataZoo were one of those very interesting early DSPs. DataZoo, the focus was very much on in-house brands, wasn't it? Almost bypassed agencies, or is that fair to say?
Yeah, it was. We had agency clients as well, but we were putting a bet down around the extent to which people would take control of their own digital marketing, especially. Television had always historically been controlled by agencies, by the big trading agreements. It was very hard for people who didn't have an agency holdco relationship to kind of be on the big screen. But mobile and web advertising was very different. And the emerging world of connected TV was different again. And so the demand side platforms really offered a route into more control, more ownership of that decisioning. So we had a lot of brands direct, and that was the bet, whereas others, people like the Trade Desk, etc., were going the other way and saying, actually, this is a very agency focused proposition. DataZoo kind of took a different tack.
So I think firstly we should probably get into what Roku is. I think in my head I'm so familiar with you guys at this point, but I think it might just be good to explain Roku's business, maybe just from the outset, what it fundamentally is as a company.
Yeah, I think it is. It's a sort of quite confusing for those people not kind of in this day to day. So Roku is essentially an operating system designed specifically for televisions. And so we people would know Roku maybe through it actually being the operating system on their TV. We work with lots of OEMs, original equipment manufacturers, the likes of JVC, TCL, Panasonic, etc., and will be the one of the operating system options they have to be on their TVs. And equally, we have a players and devices business whereby people can buy a Roku stick, plug it into the back of their TV, and get the Roku experience that way. On top of that, we also have a content proposition. And we did that because if you go back to the days of unbundling and kind of cord cutting in America, that time where everybody wanted to stop paying $100 plus for their monthly cable subscriptions, one of the things when you got a Roku device, we wanted to make sure people had free content to watch the moment they turned that TV on. And so the Roku channel was born. So we now have a content proposition alongside it. And with that, and especially in a world of content fragmentation, the number of options people now have, there's a big advertising opportunity for operating systems in the TV world. That the homepage, for example, the Roku homepage when people turn their TV on, is now one of those kind of prime time destinations, kind of akin to like a Super Bowl advertising moment, with mass reach on a daily basis. And so from placements like that, and I'm sure we'll talk about more of it in due course, there's a big ad business that now makes up the vast majority of Roku's revenue. So a very small proportion is now from kind of selling TVs and devices. The vast majority of it is platform, so content and advertising related revenue.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that world where TV manufacturers, I think a lot of people assume the operating system is just, you know, produced by the manufacturer. But in reality, yeah, TV manufacturers often choose an operating system, and there's a variety to choose from. And I'm curious about, you know, what are the things they're typically looking for from the various providers? And, you know, why are we seeing money invested in creating new operating systems? I'm curious about, you know, what goes on in the pitch meeting for when, you know, the various OSs are trying to win the business of a manufacturer.
Yeah, I think firstly, just that first decision, are you going to do your own operating system or are you going to license one? Is that first one that TV companies have got to wrestle with? And typically television companies, the people who make TVs, are very good at actually making TVs, making screens, all the technology involved in that, and then having the retail relationships to be able to sell those. What isn't necessarily their heartland is the kind of the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of investment annually that Roku puts into building a leading TV operating system. And there are a few of those out there that are licensing their OS across multiple OEMs in order to try and build the reason, to your point, that this is becoming like, and there's a few more market entrants, to build an advertising business off the back of it. People are looking at companies like Roku and wanting to try and replicate that commercial success, which makes total sense. The issue is really that there's, it's a very investment intensive operation to do well. And so when those OEMs are sitting there looking at their opportunities and what their options are for licensed OSs, they are looking at points in those pitch meetings like, okay, what opportunity do we have to share in the advertising upside post the sale of this TV? How reliable is your OS? Is it going to be the sort of thing that increases our returns rate? They'll be looking at wanting returns rates in the incredibly low single digit percentages. If you've got operating systems that just aren't robust, aren't reliable, and are leading to 5-10 percentage points in returns rate, that's a massive deal for a retailer and the OEM. And that's the difference between, in razor thin retail margins, kind of success and failure of their initiatives in a market. And so what we're seeing is OEMs putting a lot more time and effort into really thinking through their choice of licensed OS if they go down that route. There are some, the Samsungs, LGs, etc. of the world, who continue to look after their own, they run their own OSs. But Roku's worldview is very much that there will be a consolidation of that. There will be very few OSs in the long term, akin to the way the TV, PC and mobile markets played out. And that the job of the OSs that really survive all of that Shakeout is to provide a fantastically reliable platform for the OEM partners.
What do you think is going to drive that shakeout, though? I mean, the consolidation in mobile operating systems or desktop operating systems, I think that was largely driven around the need for standardization on software, particularly, or apps. And whereas in TV, I feel like, you know, people can have different operating systems and they don't even know the name of their operating system a lot of the time.
Completely.
They're more focused on, you know, are my core apps available? So what do you think will drive that consolidation?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like at a consumer level, we know, whilst we'd love it to be different, operating system is not generally one of the top three reasons you pick a TV. You're picking a TV on the price you're prepared to pay, the size of the screen, and then the quality of the picture. Now, we do think OSs, and specifically that point you mentioned, the content lineup and availability through that OS is becoming a bigger part of the way people look at it. But I actually think the things that are going to drive it are going to be the business economics behind it. You know, to my point previously, we're investing hundreds of millions of dollars of engineering and design into the Roku operating system in order to make it an industry leading and fit for purpose around trends like content discovery, around the amount of streaming apps, etc., it needs to be able to cater for, around the consumer experience for things like search, etc., etc., etc. All of these things cost a huge amount of money. And I think there won't be a big enough prize for the myriad of different OSs that are out there in future. There will be consolidation, and it'll be based around the people with the deepest pockets and the highest market share who are able to invest in that ongoing experience to continue to evolve the smart TV landscape. Some people just won't be able to afford it anymore.
And I know one problem that is caused by this platform fragmentation is, you know, creating a CTV app. I know in the early days, you know,
yes,
it was often very expensive. You had, you know, a small number of very specialist developers who would do it. It'd be quite expensive. The quality assurance process on the platform side was often quite laborious and and important in terms of maintaining standards, I suppose. But there wasn't much in the way of standardization between the different platforms. And so it was basically a custom build for each CTV platform. You know, it's not like building a website or an app where it's a little bit more transferable. Is that still the case, or has it gotten easier?
It's gotten a bit easier. There are more platforms that are consolidating around some common languages. Roku actually still uses a custom language, a BrightScript development process. And we do that because it means it drives back to the heart of why Roku is increasing its market share as a licensed operating system for TVs, in that it means it's a very light load for the processor in the TV. You don't need a huge amount of processing and memory. Those are the things that drive the cost of components, that drives the cost of the TV up. So we could have taken an easier decision, which is to say, okay, let's just bin BrightScript, let's go back to a more standard industry programming language, but it would have thrown out some of the uniqueness that actually makes Roku a really compelling proposition. So in turn, what we've done is make those processes easier. There's more shops out there that work in BrightScript. It's a lot easier for people to go find people to do that. Also, as we grow our scale, the BrightScript development is a higher priority for more companies, which really helps in terms of the speed of deployment on Roku. And we've definitely streamlined both the quality assurance and the testing, etc., process that companies go through before they can launch on Roku as well. And that's even while putting in kind of features around things like the Roku advertising watermark into our ad framework that's part of app development, which helps guarantee that any ads people are running on Roku connected TV devices, which is just a healthy thing for the ad ecosystem to be able to buy with more confidence. So we've done what we can, but we're not going to move away from BrightScript, because otherwise we lose one of those really compelling parts of why people choose Roku.
And I know you guys have been more open than most platforms when it comes to enabling CTV app developers, which in theory I find, you know, very attractive and a positive thing in terms of encouraging innovation and
Yes.
openness and people allowing people to experiment and bringing in new entrants. But it also comes at risk, of course, particularly when it comes to the number of players on your platform, and then all of a sudden, yeah, some of those players might be attracted by ad fraud. So, I mean, you guys have had a few apps on there, but we've been found to be running, basically, I wouldn't say ad fraud campaigns, but yeah, certainly running bots across their apps. How do you, as a platform, mitigate those risks and monitor it as you go?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to it, because the whilst CTV ad fraud on the Roku platform is incredibly rare, we've got to make sure that stays that way. Like TV, one of the wonderful bits about the TV ecosystem to date has been the trust that exists with buyers, and it's one of the reasons it's a premium environment. So at Roku, one of the early things we did was develop that Roku advertising watermark. And to those people and initiated in all of this, it means that publishers on the Roku platform can send ad measurement beacons, pings essentially, with that Roku advertising watermark to verify as part of the kind of the bid stream, as part of that signal that they put out to buyers, that this is indeed generated by a Roku device, an app running on a Roku device, and therefore is a connected TV impression. And what that does is it helps, firstly, buyers understand this is the connected TV they're getting, and it protects the publishers from device spoofing, which is a really big component of CTV ad fraud where it happens. And ensures that they know that this is coming from, this app, etc. So that's one of the really big pieces. And the second bit is actually partnering with the experts in the detection and prevention of this. So reporting the people like DoubleVerify, so the DV and IAS Integral partnerships are key in us being able to sort of surface and give buyers that opportunity to ensure that you don't have to take us at our word, like use the third party experts to verify that you're getting exactly what you say you're getting, and that fraud isn't an issue on the Roku platform. So it's a really good, I mean, we'll probably talk a bit more about partnerships later, but I think people kind of sticking to their swim lane and partnering with the experts in others in order to drive the best outcomes for buyers and for advertisers is a big thing we're seeing a lot more of in this industry, even in the last 12 months. And that's how Roku approaches it for the fraud point.
Let's get into the partnerships while I'm thinking of it. I mean, you've had two, well, maybe you've had more, but the two ones that come to my mind, the Amazon partnership that you launched earlier in the year was big news.
Yes.
Amazon are, striking partnerships left, right, front, and center at the moment. And I think it's been an incredibly impressive year. I'm curious about your relationship with them and how it works.
Yeah, the Amazon partnership. So we launched it earlier this year. It's live in the US and Canada, and we'll look to extend it. And essentially, it's about us for Roku side of things being able to work with Amazon and tap into and make Roku inventory a higher preference option on connected TV for buyers who are using all of that retail signal and retail intent that Amazon hold. So through the Amazon DSP, people are now able to access Roku media with the combination of Roku's first party, like logged in data, that identity signal, alongside all of that data Amazon now holds around retail and purchase intent signal, buying history, etc. Those two in combination are a really powerful view that make inventory more valuable for buyers in certain advertising sectors. It's not for everybody. It's not a big deal in the automotive piece, for example, but in retail and related sectors, it's absolutely huge. And this is something that kind of a partnership of this nature, Roku did operate a DSP. We are now very much an open platform and now partnering with Amazon. So whereas we compete on things like, I know, the Amazon Fire operating system and Fire Sticks versus Roku devices, We're also very much advertising partners, and Amazon Prime is a huge content partner on the Roku platform, invests considerable amount in promotion of that content. So a really good version of just how that frenemy spectrum continues to exist at scale in our industry.
Yeah, it always intrigues me. And yeah, you can sometimes assume that companies are fierce rivals, and you know that they'd never work with each other, but more often than not, they often find that
Absolutely. And as long as you can build in the right parts and parameters into that relationship, so you're able to compete in areas where you need to, you can collaborate where you need to, and there isn't pressure being brought from one area to bear on another, then those are really healthy kind of relationships, and you then, you know, win and lose for all the right reasons.
And you recently announced your new Fast lineup, which I have had a breeze through. Tell me about the launch of your Fast offering.
Absolutely, yeah. Actually, in your last podcast with Keith from Whirl, you highlighted the Flood household is a Roku household. So it's great that you've seen the launch of that. We launched that at the start of October. It's been a little late coming to the UK. We've had it for a while now in Mexico, Brazil, US, Canada. But it's very much a recognition about the way that consumers watch TV. Like we could talk a little bit more about like content discovery, etc. But if you go all the way back to that Thinkbox paper of 2018, where they looked at the need states for consumers, the kind of the lean back experience, the not having to really make decisions about what you want to watch, find something you're comfortable with, and kind of let that wash over you for a while, is a really big part of viewing. And so launching fast means that we're able to get 40 plus, I think it was 43 channels at launch of kind of very genre specific interest areas, whether you're, you know, wanting to in the halcyon glow of the European Ryder Cup win, just sit down and watch PGA highlights, whether you're a home and DIY enthusiast getting ready for the next set of bank holidays next summer with this old house, or pets, crime, etc., all those kind of key genres that people can really get stuck into, we're now able to cater for on a fast basis, and that all lives in the Roku channel. But it's going really well, exactly as we saw those launches when we did it in those other markets. You know, it performs great.
So yeah, in the interest of full disclosure, I should stress we are a Roku household, and I won a TV at a lunch for journalists. I got picked out the hat, and I was given another Roku device. So we have, I think you've gotten a great value for money. So, but my reference point for CTV is often a Roku device, and I often talk about your ad units that I'm seeing as well. So I feel like.
Amazing.
I feel like just putting the message out there that giving stuff to journalists works.
Journalism's in a very hard time. A Roku device is the least we can do.
Nice organic reach. Our traffic is growing. We're not having a hard time.
Great, great.
We keep checking and waiting for ChatGPT to wipe us out, but it's not happening yet. I think the first thing ChatGPT will wipe out is LinkedIn, which the posts I'm seeing, it's just having a very negative impact. Anyway, so what about TV commerce? And what I mean by that, I think it can mean different things to different people, but I'm talking about a sales transaction taking place directly on the TV screen.
Yes.
There was a huge amount of noise around it last year, and definitely some big announcements. But do you think it's rising up the agenda, you know, as the technology improves? And do you think it's going to be scalable and something that we can really grow?
To a point. I mean, I think the TV commerce, in the broadest sense, TV commerce is an absolutely enormous area of potential for all of the people that are part of this ecosystem. But the actual purchase on a TV device, I think it is, you know, it's here. We have it. We're doing it with Walmart in the US for a limited set of their catalog. It's absolutely an option, and it drives There's a value proposition for it. It drives value and transactions that might not have happened or might not have happened with that retailer otherwise. What I would say that it's only a small part of really what TV commerce actually is. There's kind of a, if you broadly simplify the cohorts of marketers involved in the those areas where that type of transaction could happen, because people aren't buying cars through their TVs yet, but they may well transact for lower consideration type of goods and services. But there's kind of broadly and incredibly simplistically two sets of marketers: the people who are that cohort schooled in things like IPA effectiveness studies, disciples of Binet and Field studies, the people who, and actually this should still be required reading for everybody, the long and short of it. Those are people who've known that TV advertising drives sales revenue down the line. You haven't been able to track it in the same way that you can do now, but things like multi-touch attribution studies and longitudinal studies would tell you about the value of television advertising. Now, there's another cohort, and let's pick a persona of a sort of a direct-to-consumer brand, typically a younger company. Younger individuals, their marketing investment has typically been more invested with things like social platforms, and their measure of success is now. Their ability to see success is measured in social media transaction dashboards, where they're looking at conversions in near real time. But those companies are evolving, and things like their next step is getting into television, that'll drive the next stage of their growth. What we have to work with those organizations on is really this idea of it's not just about transactions on the TV set, but it's also about shortening the purchase cycle through initiatives like, well, let's say the OK to the OK button on your remote, rather than needing to use the QR code, still an option. We can actually leverage people's registration data on the Roku platform and allow that connection. Where they can be emailed by the brand that they're interested in directly for that, car, for that holiday, for that product they've just seen, using the OK to button on the remote. Equally, we are able to kind of shorten the path to purchase for consideration areas. If we take the automotive showcase ad unit, that can actually do a lot of the work that would have had to go into either showroom visits or kind of other forms of marketing from an automotive manufacturer. So we're able to shorten a purchase cycle. And when you look at all of these opportunities that exist, that in its entirety is what we would term kind of TV commerce. And that's even without partnerships. We talked about the Amazon piece and retailers using connected TV for audience extension on their own retail media. That entirety of spend is kind of bundled under this TV commerce area. And I think that when you look at all of that in its entirety, that's what makes the real opportunity. So yes, transactions on the TV works, but we can't forget that it would only work for a certain set of categories, and TV has still got a huge amount of lean back thing. Not every ad is going to be shoppable, nor should it be in future.
Yes, no, yeah, I'm very much inclined to agree. And I find myself getting a little bit frustrated with those sort of DR focused advertisers who, when their only experience of advertising is Facebook, and like you say, that original, like there's a huge market education piece, which we talk about all the time at CTV conferences or Video Week conferences. And I can see the same sessions happening at other events. And but that effectiveness bit just doesn't really seem to filter through, and people are
No.
often taking metrics they're handed by, social networks at face value as well, which I find really worrying, actually.
It is really worrying because I can't remember who there's a bunch of people who kind of claim to be the architect of it. Was it Peter Drucker, Lord Kelvin? But this idea of you can't measure it, you can't improve it, that logic is like makes a huge amount of sense, but equally there's some things that are going on with TV advertising that you can't measure in the time frame that social media platforms reporting has always said, this is how you define effectiveness. And so, I mean, to kind of plug ITV, if Reese were here, one of the things Reese would be talking about would be things like the ITV's fat end of the long tail strategy about how they're growing into the next size and scale of advertiser, and ad units like lead gen ads, where people are able to, by kind of clicking on the screen during the ad, they're able to allow their data to be shared with an advertiser who can then talk to them afterwards, and tools for media planners like Outcomes Planner, which takes a far longer term view of what the of what success looks like. I think initiatives like that from a very seasoned broadcaster with a huge amount of market share in TV trading in the UK, is these are really helpful initiatives that are going to mean that the people in charge of money and budget allocations are more informed in future.
And just speaking of ITV, I should acknowledge that they picked up a gong for their advertising innovation at the European Video Awards a few weeks ago. But they, one of a big focus for them and for broadcasters, and I'm guessing for you guys, is the SME market, or SMBs as
Yes.
it's sometimes called.
Yep.
What are you guys doing in that space, and do you see a significant opportunity, and what's going to drive it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this all falls under this kind of idea of sort of the larger theme of the democratization of TV. And for those of the listeners who aren't maybe old enough to remember the good old days of television advertising, TV in the UK would maybe have 2,000 to 3,000 brands on it in any given year across all of the major channels. And those were defined by the people who worked with the biggest agency holding companies who had all of the trading agreements for TV airtime. We're now in a very different world of television with tens of thousands of apps and channels out there, and a lot more self-serve buying platforms that allow people access to the big screen without needing to be a client of WPP or Dentsu, etc. And so we have this proliferation of brands that are now in the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, soon to be millions of brands that will appear on TV screens in any given year instead. And to facilitate that, the first piece is really about making trading really simple. And you have to hand it to the social platforms. They were able to make small and medium-sized ad budgets accessible, and they've hoovered those up. And it's been a huge part of why they are the size and scale that they are now. The TV organizations are now working to build those buying platforms, those interfaces that allow smaller organizations without the same media buying expertise to easily define their objectives, to define the location of audiences they're interested in reaching, to be able to work with tools now that can actually create a 30-second video ad unit, for example, without needing a 5-10K production budget, which they're never going to be able to devote to it. And actually get live on the screen. So Roku has Roku Ads Manager that's had a very successful launch and growth in the US. We actually have a version of it live here for our media and entertainment clients, but we will extend that in due course. And as you look across the industry, things like Universal Ads and other tools are going to really bring this to bear. And it was interesting just seeing the way that we do things right now is by working with platforms. So let's take somebody like a Magnite. So Roku partners with Magnite, or we partner with many different SSPs and DSPs. But Magnite, I highlight because they actually just bought Streamer.ai, part of that kind of set of productivity to actually generate creative for TV. That smaller and medium-sized enterprises can use, and that's now part of their stack. And that's a really good example of just how this market is becoming more accessible for smaller companies.
One of the, I mean, moving from smaller companies on the buy side to smaller creators on the sell side,
Yes.
I've been curious about why we haven't seen much of a play from the CTV world when it comes to competing with YouTube, who, are very openly, talking about competing with TV,
Yes.
whilst also partnering with TV, as is our industry's way. But YouTube success, I mean, it hinges on a huge number of variables that sort of have turned it into the sort of huge success that it is. But I think one of the main ones is, right, it's a great place for people to simply discover a huge range of content. And, you know, they benefit from, you know, not having to pay upfront. But, you know, the weak link in that chain, I think, is that by not paying upfront, they don't own the content or have exclusivity in most, you know. Now, I'm not oblivious to the fact that TikTok and Instagram and various other players are competing with them on the social front. But I'm always curious that, you know, as a TV operating system, you often have, you know, a huge amount of first party data on your users, and often at a household level. You know, I've wondered why we haven't seen, you know, any the TV side, you know, doing a little bit more to enable popular creators to reach TV audiences. I mean, you know, there's been some, you know, Mr. Beast have done stuff with has done stuff with Amazon, for example, or, you know, there have been certainly cases, but, you know, for example, you guys are Roku. You've probably worked out that I'm, you know, a Manchester United fan, and you know, or that my other half might be interested in makeup tutorials. I mean, she's not into makeup tutorials, but just that's always a classic video type. But you know, but that I might be able to subscribe to that content within the CTV operating system. You know, am I being commercially naive or about the infrastructure and the deals required to make this happen? Or, you know, do you think that this is something we might see in the future?
I think it's something you might see in the future, but I don't know that it would be driven, for example, by Roku or the platform. So if we go back to what our job is here, it's about making sure that all of the content people really enjoy is available on their TV, which means accessible through the Roku operating system. And if we look at those locations, for example, like YouTube is for connected TV, like the biggest of those apps that is that has that creator content within it. I think there's a battle right now in that creator economy around the economics of the distribution platform versus what the creator gets themselves from all of that remuneration. From all of that kind of commercial agreements that they have. And you could definitely see a world, it would need to be led by some pretty hefty creators themselves, where a different distribution option is chosen instead, or as well as YouTube. Now, we would absolutely, as a platform, be open to making that available. And if viewers choose to watch that, watch a little bit less YouTube and watch this new thing, then, you know, there they would be on Roku. I think we definitely work with our publishing partners in terms of helping them. It's part of that partnership idea that Roku has of sharing in the value, in the upside that people get from distribution on our platform, and things like understanding viewing habits and really understanding how they can attract incremental audiences and embedding in content discovery features are all a big part of that. And so I definitely think we would help it. I don't know that we would drive it, and it would need a almost a creator-led effort to make that next distribution vehicle, but we would absolutely work with that vehicle when it arrives.
I think people have tried over the years and struggled with it. You know, they'll often, paying chunky money to get, you know, top creators over to, you know, I think Twitch have done it at various points. And then, yeah, I think there've been some other sort of startup apps sort of trying to create a new destination, maybe around a particular vertical, and it has been tough. But yeah, what I'm thinking more is, but people who have a ready-made audience, you know, or app environment, and it's just being automatically surfaced. Hey, you know, we know that you're interested in Manchester United. Here's, you know, three creators. Yeah, and to just be able to tap the button on the TV screen. I'm thinking partly as somebody who I'm not a huge user of YouTube on the TV screen. Often when I do, I think it's an amazing experience, and kind of wonder why I don't do it more. But I haven't developed that muscle memory yet. I'm usually have my 1 hour, which I want to be a top quality drama and nothing else.
Well, I mean, firstly, I'm sorry, your TV experience is meant to be one of those either entertaining, uplifting, and like it's meant to be a life-enhancing one. And as a Manchester United fan, regrettably, that's not going to have been the case for you of recent years. You have to have a pretty good memory for that. But the so what you're talking about this goes into one of those really interesting areas, and actually part of what costs an absolute fortune in developing the OS is all of that user interface and user experience design. So one of the things that we've recently launched on the platform is things like what to watch. And that's machine learning based view of your household's viewing patterns to be able to then surface relevant things for you. So and this would include both the type of, so let's say for example, traitors went on yesterday in on the BBC. The BBC is a distribution partner. That would be something that might be, depending on the Flood viewing habits, that might be one of the things that would be highlighted in that row. So a huge program from a hugely popular broadcaster. But equally, knowing you're a Man United fan, then maybe the Man United app is one of the next ones, because there's an interview on the reasons and causes for Man United's latest failure that you should be kept up to date with. And so that would be the next one. Whereas, and the final one in there is maybe a fast channel all around kind of fashion and beauty, because that's that in the fictitious Flood household, that is that next viewing interest or genre, and that would be different to mine, et cetera, and it would evolve over time as the programming and content available from all of the apps on the platform. But things like what to watch is exactly that type of facility that an OS should provide for users in order to satisfy that kind of viewing need state. But it's really about, like, how does that content get created? Like, YouTube wouldn't play in that type of world. Maybe a different type of vehicle would go and do it. Or if those creators are actually kind of big enough to be able to do their own thing. Let's pick the Mr. Beast channel, for example. That could absolutely be something that gets promoted in there organically based on your viewing preferences.
Yeah, no. Yeah, just on the Manchester United point, my interest in Manchester United news is actually inversely proportional to their success on the pitch. I'm a glutton for punishment, and the analysis seems to be a lot more interesting for me when things are going wrong rather than when they're going well. Okay, final question. If you had 10 million to invest, where would you invest it and why? It can be within the industry, outside of it. You're not allowed to give it to a charity. If you want to, we'll give you an extra 10 million for a
Oh, well,
charity.
now I'm going to feel really bad that you said you're allowed to give to charity. Let's assume that I'm a cold-blooded capitalist, and I'm going to take my $10 million and put it into something I should know something about. I think, look, there's a few interesting areas. One of them, like if we'd been talking about this like a couple of years ago, I think I'd probably have said either kind of creative tools, because that's going to be one of the big parts about trying to get the next generation, the next scale of advertiser onto the big screen. But I sort of feel I've missed that boat. Equally, there is a standards problem. Like we need to fix standards and make far more things far simpler for far more buyers in order to really scale the CTV ad opportunity. But I think the single biggest thing that I would do, and at the risk of parroting Keith from last episode, that measurement attribution space is where I would be putting my money. I think there's a huge amount of work going on into it right now, but I think being able to come up with, you only have to look at the UK with what's going on at Barb, with Lantern, with Origin, various others. We have not solved for this problem. There's a huge amount of innovation going into there, and I think having an audience tied to outcomes in a standardized way as humanly possible, made as accessible as humanly possible to non-experts in kind of decision science and all of the rigor that's gone into TV research over the last 50 years, that's where I would put my 10 million.
It is. I don't think Keith was necessarily the first to have said that either.
No.
And in every conference, every private conversation, when I ask people what their number one problem is, I think measurement and attribution, just being able to fully demonstrate that it works. The unfortunate thing is that rival channels, social networks particularly, often get away with very woolly metrics, but it's a nice number that people can bring back to the boss.
It is. I think this is one of the. It's great when you go to a conference and Ian Dowd, the CEO of UCOM, is there. He'll always be the person who puts his hand up and says, "Where does that data come from?" And so many people get away with marking their own homework. The measurement really ought to be. Whilst sure, the publisher can play into it. It has to be a third party, an independent third party with no axe to grind, no fear or favor on the outcomes, that are the people who should be the trusted source of whether or not this has done what it was trying to do. And you know, we're in this world right now where marketers are sort of suffering their version of the fate of Ophelia, drowning in data all over the place, and it ought to be the standard, like Barb was for viewing back in the day in TV. There has to be an independent view on outcomes, audience, etc., that we go and get to. And so, you're right; it'll still be a thing in conferences to come. But hopefully, my 10 million, which I'll send you my bank details that you can wire it to, will go some way towards fixing.
It's on the way. Yeah.
Thanks.
Our payment
Fantastic.
systems are known for letting us down. So just let us know if you've received it. Well, I think many people will still think that Hugh Grant is operating under a pseudonym and is masquerading on coming on Video Week podcast. But thanks so much for taking the time. Really enjoyed that chat, as always. And yeah, really did feel like the type of conversations that we would have when we're not recording. So, yeah, thanks for that.
Vincent, thank you. Always a pleasure. Speak soon.